to and where they are going. I'm Mari Nursenback Beecher, and I represent Sunstone in chairing this session. Let me tell you a bit of my personal odyssey with this family. These women come from a line of the strongest women I have read. They come out of southern Alberta. Their foremothers pioneered there, midwives and farmers, and the stock is firm, and it's wonderful to see that the branches are just as strong. This is Arta, and this is Patty, and this is Catherine, and this is Becky. And it's been wonderful to get to know this whole generation and see the strength that's coming forth. I asked Arta to put together some material out of which to make an introduction. And it is wonderful that there's nothing on here that you normally hear in an introduction. So I'm going to read it to you the way Arta wrote it, which will be a much better introduction than if I told you where they graduated from and what their professions are. Arta writes, "We have not brought a learned paper to this conference, but one that comes out of our lived experience, one of having taken women's studies classes this year. Arta went back to school after 27 years away, leaping into the books with a class called Philosophy and the Status of Women. Patty's class was called The Images of Women and Men in Popular Culture. She's the family expert on minutiae and a formidable opponent if you play Trivial Pursuit, and I challenge you with my husband on the other side."
You're on.
Oh, he plays both. He has to. He's married to a Canadian. Catherine asked her mother to join her in a women's studies class called Women in Canada. Then Catherine spent most of her time in class trying to prevent her mother from asking questions. I heard about the supper table at which Catherine came in and said, "Mother asked three questions today in a row." That sounds like I would love to have been under that supper table. Catherine had the good fortune to play basketball on the U of Calgary women's team, who won one gold and two silver medals at the national finals, and whose team holds the North American record for the most consecutive wins by a university women's basketball team, 69 games. And they were in Sports Illustrated, not the bathing suit issue. Yeah, that would have brought money. Rebecca's women's studies class was called Feminist Legal Theory. She's in her final year of law school, and we should tell you that Catherine is now in her first year of medical school. She's in her final year of law school. This week, her favorite feminist authors. I love the "this week" bit. I told Art I was going to send her a book, and she said, "We probably already have it, but try." Her favorite authors this week are Robin West, Catherine McKinnon, and Mary Daly. We will proceed then in the order in which they're given in your program with the prepared papers, but do have your questions ready. And we'll look for a lively interchange because the panel has some questions for you as well as you having questions for the panel. I'm delighted now to introduce the Johnson women.
You haven't been introduced to my husband, Kelvin. Kelvin has been a college teacher or a high school English teacher for most of our married life. The study of English has been both his vocation and his avocation. So he often talks to us about language and literature. Though the study of language theory would not be high on any of our lists of things to study, it has been high on his. Thus, we've spent much of our time at home discussing language, the nature of language, and the problem of understanding what people mean by the words they use. Kelvin has introduced us to many ideas about language that might never have occurred to us otherwise. With that introduction to the patriarch of the family, I would like to tell you that there are more of us in the family than you see here today. So many more that in order to get a kitchen table, I had to have Kelvin take an 8-foot piece of plywood, put Arborite on it, put a set of legs under it, and that's where we eat. Initially, I loved this table because it lacked the traditional split through the middle by which ordinary tables are extended for larger families. I was spared the task of digging out the dried food that always collected in the crack. Now I love this table for a different reason. Groups of people can sit around it comfortably, And over the years, the table has become a place where we meet, eat, play, and talk. I wouldn't be surprised if one of the children wrote a book about it called Around the Arborite. Of late, the conversations there have focused on feminism. Because we now sit at the table with adult children, these discussions are both intense and lengthy. The only rule we have is this: if you don't want to be part of the discussion, you can go do other things. The discussions are unstructured. People come into them at odd times and leave whenever, to return perhaps, perhaps not. We try not to offend one another, but in the discussions, the women are more comfortable than the men. Of the men, Kelvin seems the best able to sustain the stress, so he stays with us the longest. Let me recount a particular conversation that took place at 5 o'clock one Sunday afternoon. Besides Kelvin and myself, Bonnie was there, and my 21-year-old daughter Catherine, with whom I took the women's studies class. My son-in-law Steve and an older son Trail were there, whom are firmly grounded in the patriarchal tradition. Rebecca, my eldest daughter, was there, distressed at the degree of patriarchal bias that she finds in the law faculty and the incompatibility of this with her own feminist feelings. The topic on that particular day was no doubt some aspect of feminism. However, as I told you, Kelvin was an English teacher, so you can be sure that language concerns were not far from the surface of the discussion. For years, he has been telling us that all language is imperative. Despite the fact that he has been thinking and talking about this for most of Rebecca's life, its usefulness was not truly apparent to her until the past year. She sensed a conflict between her father's ideas about language and language theory and the practices of her strongly biased male law faculty. Her father's talk told her, words do not have meanings. People have meanings for words. And that all language is imperative. And that language is experienced differently at the center and at the circumference of consciousness. And that communication is the negotiation of meaning. This combination of ideas had placed her at the circumference, as it were, of patriarchal language practice. I might also add that Kelvin's wife and 4 daughters have committed him to come to terms with women's ideas about language, like those that you will read in Dale Spender's Man-Made Language, or the ideas that you'll find in the book called Women's Ways of Knowing. Kelvin has been changing in his sphere as we've been changing in ours. All of this is background information to help you understand how the following simple conversation became the object of an in-depth discussion of male and female language interaction. At 5 o'clock one Sunday evening, Doral, my 22-year-old political science son, walked into the house. Whatever we had been talking about was interrupted by Kelvin asking me, "Has Doral eaten yet?" I was tuned into the table conversation, and I was interrupted by Kelvin's question. Wanting to both quickly get back into the conversation and to practice some of the language theory that Kelvin so often blesses us with, I responded, "I don't know. Doral is 22 years old. If he's hungry, he can go get something out of the fridge." Bonnie, our 23-year-old, leaned over to me and whispered, "Thank you. The knot in my stomach just disappeared." I replied, "Tell your father what you just said to me." Bonnie did this, and the topic of conversation shifted to Kelvin's favorite topic, but with him on the hot seat. He quietly listened for a long while to a critique of his language practice and theory. First, I supplied the group with a reconstruction of what went on in the privacy of my mind during this brief exchange. I knew that the question, "Has Doral eaten yet?" was directed at me, and these ideas went through my head. I know he is asking me to do something, but I don't know if he is asking me to give him information or to feed Doral. If he is asking for information, he is saying, "Tell me if Doral has eaten yet," but I cannot supply him with that information. I have been sitting beside Kelvin in church all day, and Doral has been at the department store. I do not know if Doral has eaten. So Kelvin must be asking me something else. Maybe he is saying, "Go get Doral food." Now, Kelvin and I do have expressed concerns about Doral. We are concerned about his family relations, his physical survival, his economic condition, his social, psychological, and intellectual development, even if he is 23. The message could be, here comes Doral. We need to draw him into the family discussion. We can do this with food. So you go get him the food and bring him into the discussion because you're better at that than I am. Or he could have been saying to me, acknowledge that Doral is here. Say hello and shower him with attention. Or it could have been a remnant of Kelvin's own childhood worry about not having enough food, and he could be saying, here comes one of your children who might starve if you don't take care of him. I could be hearing, help Doral save money for summer school, feed him at home so he won't be spending money on fast food. Other people at the table supplied their private thoughts. Rebecca had heard Kelvin's question, and she confessed, I have been getting practice at law school ignoring patriarchal imperatives. I hear a lot of messages directed at me. I know I can only do a certain number of them. I chose to receive no message when I heard Father speak. Bonnie, on the other hand, said, I did hear Dad's question. I immediately had a knot in my stomach thinking, Mother is tired. I will jump up and get food so she doesn't have to do it, but I am exhausted also. I leapt back into the conversation again. Because before Bonnie could get up, I had finished all this sorting process that I had described to you was going on in my head, and I responded to Kelvin, I don't know, Doral is 22, if he wants food, let him go to the fridge. I knew in saying this that I was running a risk in making Kelvin angry. Let me assure you, this is not my usual way of dealing with things, and Kelvin would not have expected this response from me. Bonnie added the following to the interchange now at the table. When I whispered in your ear, thank you, the knot in my stomach just disappeared. It was because I had experienced such a sense of relief with your reply. I felt that you had taken the risk for me. So I added, because Bonnie had only whispered her thanks to me, I told her to make public to Kelvin what she had told me so that he would know what she had heard in his question. I was taking a risk that he might think I was diverting his anger away from me, but I was also aware that two of us had heard him say, go feed Doral. Everyone at our table has heard Kelvin say that he does not want to make the women he loves into his slaves, and I believe him. But his question was doing to us the very thing that he does not want to do. Kelvin, who had sat silently listening to this roasting, was finally invited by Bonnie to share his thoughts. How did Mother's answer to your question make you feel? Still a little hurt, he replied quietly. I felt a little miffed and not understood. Okay, I felt the patriarchal assumption that a mother is always happy to nurture and comfort her children was being attacked. I guess I was responding as if Arta were saying, believe me, I could care less whether Doral has eaten or not. In Arta's response, there seemed to be an edge of resentment directed at my cherished patriarchal imperatives. So the conversation at the dinner table focused not only on this little lived experience as seen both from the center and from the circumference of consciousness, but also on the inferences that men and women draw when in conversation. The family talked about this little conversation for many weeks to follow. We think it illustrates so much that is typical, and I love to share my feelings, having been freed to think in a new way. Deep in women's hearts, we have always known that language does in fact command you to do something, and we have always acted accordingly. But I, for one, have had no way to articulate this explicitly. Now, as a family group, we began looking closely at the way people spoke to us, and we started identifying the implicit imperatives, that is, what were we really being asked to do? I had to find out what the implicit imperatives were in the three sentence types, in the question, in the assertion, and in the exclamation. Questions are easy. They are simply commands for information, like, tell me, what's it? Or, tell me, when does the movie start? Or, tell me, what time will Mary be home? But many questions seem to be commands not for information, but they are commands or requests to do something. For example, I think most of us have seen the following interaction. The family sits down to dinner, and the father says, is there any bread? and the wife jumps up and brings bread to the table. If this were a simple command for information, yes or no would be the appropriate answer. Clearly, there are imperatives embedded within imperatives, or different levels of implication. Then we looked at the assertive sentence. Those usually appear to be statements of fact. They are commands or requests to do something in the mind, mostly to believe. However, the statement, "Once upon a time there lived a beautiful princess," is telling you to imagine. Most novels or stories are imperatives of this kind. "So, what do you do with Bonnie's thank you?" asked one of the more skeptical members of the group. Kelvin loves to deal at length with this kind of challenge to theory, but I will subject you to only a brief version of the answer. "Thank you" is an exclamatory sentence. It is an implicit version of the explicit command, "feel appreciated." In its non-ironic use, it can be taken as an implicit performative declaration of indebtedness. The equivalent explicit imperative would be, "Witness that I declare my indebtedness to you for whatever." I had noticed that Bonnie followed her thank you with why she was thanking me. The knot in my stomach just disappeared. Loosely translate explicit imperative, she was saying, "Do feel appreciated, Mother, and know that I owe you for taking the knot out of my stomach." As Bonnie explained to the group, Mother's response freed me from what I had taken to be Father's imperative and a false map of my responsibility. The fundamentally imperative nature of language was clear. The imperative sentence was structurally explicit. The exclamation, the question, and the assertion were implicit imperatives. Any one of them could have second, third, and fourth level implicit imperatives embedded in them. For example, the question, "Has Doral eaten yet?" is on the first level a simple request for information. I responded at this level when I said, "I don't know." In the lippy part of my reply, I was responding level implied imperative, "Get up and get Doral food." This can best be seen in the context of unexpressed concerns which both Kelvin and I were party to. Now, all of this is clear to every woman who has had to deal with patriarchal language habits. However, embedded in the second-order imperatives, "Go get Doral some food," are a series of third-order imperatives that are distinctly patriarchal. They are a series of implicit "believe me" imperatives, the purpose of which is to persuade or remind women or a woman that it is her duty to carry out the second-order imperative, "Get Doral food." These third-order imperatives can be made explicit as a series of assertions. It is a woman's responsibility to nurture and feed the children. Women do this better than men, etc. Taken together, they can be thought of as a blueprint to guide women in their work. I submit to you that men would have women believe that this blueprint is a map of reality, the truth about women's nature. This embeddedness of imperatives is true of language practices generally, not just of patriarchal language practice. When a mother says to her child, "Bake a cake," it seems like a simple imperative. But implicit in it are a host of subordinate imperatives, one group of which is called the recipe. A recipe is itself a blueprint or a plan. It's an agenda for building a cake. A map is also a plan in a drafting sense, but it is a representation of what exists, not a representation of what may be constructed. So we see that there is complexity in the tissue, in the imperative tissue of language, levels of embeddedness, and various degrees of generalization. To deal with all of this requires a great deal of rational thought on the part of women or men. Remember, Kelvin could ask a simple question and mobilize three women to have knots in their stomach, to feel their tiredness and resentment, or to purposely withdraw. How often have men, not familiar with the nature of this exchange, been amazed at the responses of women and labeled them irrational or intuitive? And how often have women, not articulate about the nature of their experience, accepted this assertion about their irrationality as though it were a map of reality? How irrational are women? They have had to develop a highly efficient rationality to understand language in its implicit and complex imperative forms, while dealing with men who have fooled themselves into thinking that language is something else, a means by which to exercise their patriarchal right to enunciate truth, to lay out the map of reality. Men's map tells us that women are intuitive. They comfort, nurture, understand, and respond to the needs of men and children without men having to articulate the details of their desires or having to negotiate for their realization. And furthermore, unless women respond as if this were all true, women are somehow out of touch with reality. Here we have a clear case of blueprint confused with map on a global scale. When all of this became clear to me, it wasn't hard to figure out what to do next. I claimed my right to ask the question, why should I do what you are asking me to do? And in time I was to discover that this why question is always the why question always follows the same general form. I would hear the clear imperative, do this, because, and then the reason would follow. The reasons that followed were of only two kinds. First, either it fits my map of reality, or it suits the blueprint of my vision. In either case, I knew I had the right to be persuaded, in the first case, of the truth of the map, or in the second case, of the blueprint's relevance to my desires. I grew up in a world where beyond the classroom it was generally impertinent for women to ask questions. Knowing that questions are tell-me imperatives, I am feeling free to say to people, A, tell me exactly what it is you want me to do. B, convince me that cooperation with your program, your blueprint, your itinerary, your map, your agenda is in my best interest also. What will it do for me? I've been hearing about this theory for a long time, but I've only been thinking about its implications for women for a short time. I love thinking about the theory. What has come of practicing it at the dinner table has been fascinating for me. And, lest you worry about Doral and whether he ever did get his supper, let me say he was only passing on through the kitchen on his way to take his girlfriend out to dinner. That wonderful son is patriarchal enough to know that our conversation couldn't possibly have concerned him.
This is typical of visual aids, they're falling down. To start, I should tell you how I, so obviously from a different genetic pool, came to be at the Arborite Forum. I first came as a friend of Rebecca's. She was rebelling about not being allowed to stay at school for lunch, and the compromise she reached with Arda was that she could bring her friends home for lunch. In typical adolescent fashion, Rebecca traipsed 13 of us home the first day, all with the assurance that my mum won't mind at all. She didn't. And I was a frequent participant in this lunchtime assault, and I've been at the table from time to time ever since. So often, in fact, that I'm now considered family. This may also be due to the fact that I married Trell, the second oldest, but that is beside the point. My particular slant on the imperative theme comes from my coursework in images of men and women in popular culture, and more particularly on advertising imagery. Learning the skills of image analysis helped me to deal more effectively with the barrage of images which present themselves to each of us every day. Once I recognized the imaging and verbal techniques advertisers were using, it became much easier to defend myself against this constant bombardment. The volume of images itself contributes to the overall impact of gender portrayal in all forms of the media. The images we see reflect, reinforce, and even help create cultural standards of femininity and masculinity. The images can be seen as gauges of the role society expects its members to play, in essence, a standard to live up or down to. The gap between how people are portrayed and their sociological reality is what sparked my interest in this area. My initial paper looked at advertising imagery between 1932 and 1972 in Chatelaine magazine, which is a Canadian women's magazine. The premise was to demonstrate that although society as a whole had experienced radical changes, there had been very little change in the images of women. And this was the bias that I brought to the Arborite Forum. Now, it would be very easy to dismiss the imperative as a given in advertising, To quote Judith Williamson, "You must already have chosen when you buy. Otherwise, the advertisement has failed in its purpose. That is why it is so crucial for the advertisement to enter you, to exist inside rather than outside your self-image, and in fact, to create it. But how does advertising have this effect on us, and what imperatives underlie the push to buy? Media images present themselves as maps. And so, people tend to deal with the information in the images as if it were reality. We often tend to deal with advertisements as if they were true or false, as if they were a statement of fact. We would be better off to recognize that true or false is a secondary, if not entirely irrelevant, issue in advertising. The point is not the information we are receiving, but rather the imperatives and the public negotiation over what we want and need. It is more important to realize that what we are being told to do or to believe, in other words, to recognize what the blueprint is and to decide whether or not you want to participate. Once you get past this explicit imperative to buy, the bulk of advertising is simply a set of imperatives or reasons why you should buy the product. As artist stated, the because statement. Images are utilized to establish the need for a particular product. A good example is the Elizabeth Taylor Passion Perfume campaign. What the advertisers are trying to establish with us is a cognitive connection between being Elizabeth Taylor and using the product. What they're telling each of us is, use this product and be as glamorous as Elizabeth Taylor. Some of the underlying imperatives are, believe me, using this product will make you as glamorous as Elizabeth Taylor. This is what a glamorous woman is. And to be acceptable and valued as a woman, this is what you must be like. Use this perfume or you will be out of touch, not valued, not a real woman. The image is presented to us as a map, i.e., this is what a real valued woman is. So if Elizabeth Taylor is the ideal or map of glamour, why are we not confused by other perfume advertisements with appeals made by different spokespeople? Perhaps it is because we experience a sort of subconscious discomfort with the Elizabeth Taylor map anyway. The variety of perfumes and spokespeople addresses our need to feel we are making choices. Our choice depends on which spokesperson we most identify with or want to be like. In other words, which map we choose to believe in. But what we're seldom aware of is we're not given the choice between true alternatives. Never are we presented with the option not to use perfume. The pernicious imperative is, you are not good enough the way you are. You are human. You emit scents. You stink. For heaven's sakes, cover it up. In reality, quite the opposite is true. Aside from basic cleanliness, the application of mink and other animal and floral pheromones would hardly make you more attractive to other humans. Most advertising like this appeals to human insecurities about ourselves, how we are perceived by others, and how closely we conform to society's expectations of who we ought to be. There it is. In this Sanaflush ad, it's a little dated, but it works. This Sanaflush ad has several layers of meaning. The primary assumption, the map, is that women stay at home or at least do the housework. It is assumed to be the women's responsibility, nay, even moral obligation, to keep the house clean. On the next level is the implied imperative that your friends will be sufficiently insensitive to discuss your perceived housekeeping inadequacies behind your back. There is also this bizarre notion that someone else's toilets are of sufficient interest to warrant discussion and even to have negative repercussions on your social status. But what is considered sufficiently messy to hurt your social standing? But of course, the ad in its ever-helpful way suggests that we should use the product at least twice a week. What we also have to consider is the compound effect that images have on us. Jean Kilburn suggests that we are exposed to between 2,000 and 3,000 images per day. We do not have to consciously look at each image for it to have an impact. This vast quantity of imagery contributes to the problem, forming a complex network of imperatives and norms, always telling you what you ought to be. As I studied the ads, I began to see that imperatives are used and that the blueprints are proposed. Perhaps more importantly, I learned to recognize the tools that advertisers are using to set me up as their target, to make me feel they're speaking to me and about me. These are the techniques that advertisers use to co-opt all of us into their agenda, into their blueprint, to make us believe that the ad represents reality. It is in many ways very coercive. I have always felt some dissonance between myself and most of the images of women that are portrayed in the media. And now, having studied and thought about imaging, I can step back and look at advertising, analyze it, and see so much more of what is really going on. I can recognize what the advertisers are telling me to do, and although I spend much more time looking at ads now than I ever did before, they have far less power over me. Studying advertisements has also helped me realize that all media images are part of the imperative network. Advertisers use images to make economic advances. Other images use similar techniques to illustrate and reinforce concepts or to make ideological advances. So in this context, what images are we seeing expressed in the church media? What images are being supported or promoted? And are the church leaders consciously trying to promote an image of the perfect Mormon woman or man? Taking the Ensign as representative of church media as a whole, I selected a few images to illustrate the imperatives women are being given in the church. I started looking at cover art because these images are, though often linked thematically with the content of the magazine, are not designed to illustrate the points of a particular article. The images stand on their own. In this first cover, which is about to fall down, this is from March 1990. When I first looked at this picture, I saw in it very positive representation. These are real people, complete with crow's feet, wrinkles, graying hair. But something didn't quite sit right with me. So I took a step back and analyzed the cover as I would any other image. I found much more going on than I had at first glance. The image fits into the magazine's theme of strengthening the marriage, and there are articles within the magazine that quite literally contain blueprints for how to improve your marriage. The cover image, however, purports a map of what a strong marriage is or should be. On a superficial level, it bothered me that she looks up at him and he down at her. But this can be dismissed as a function of their relative height and not their comparative status. But what did bother me is that she is embracing him, and he is standing passively being embraced. This bothered me because I know I don't feel strengthened by or enriched by a hug that is not reciprocated. I was led further. Why was I only seeing the wife's face? The imperative I heard was, wives, make your marriages stronger. Be the active agent. You do the hugging and the nurturing and the work to build the relationship and keep it strong. But why must the woman do all the work? It seems irrational, even unhealthy, to expect that one partner should have to carry the whole burden of the relationship. The next image I looked at was the cover of Ensign, February 1990. Again, very many positive elements to this picture. Here's a couple actively engaged in teaching the gospel. But when I bring an analytical perspective to it, I have to ask, why is the woman standing behind? Why is she just leaning in? Is she only a marginal figure in the teaching process? Couldn't she be doing the teaching? I have to admit, I have a bias. If the husband was leaning in, would I interpret him as taking an authoritative stance? Would I interpret this as his trying to be his wife's supervisor? The other question, and a slightly side issue, is why do we have two whites teaching an obvious Hispanic the gospel? Why not a Hispanic missionary couple teaching an Anglo? I then continued on to look at how illustrative images work with their accompanying article to form a matrix of meaning. When I came across this last illustration from February 1990, an article titled Taking a Hard Look at Myself, I was very disturbed. This is the sort of image that nightmares are made of. The very large, dark, shadowy figure, my superego or conscience, is taking a hard look at myself. This picture seems more a self-denigration than any sort of positive self-examination. I also felt the imperative, believe me, people are watching you and they don't like what they see. This feeling was accompanied by a secondary message, they are right. The specter is bigger than me, society is bigger than me, bigger people know more and know better. I must not be measuring up. The article which accompanied this certainly gave quite a different set of imperatives. Yes, society is watching you, and yes, you ought to strive to be your best, but no, not everyone is going to like you, and it doesn't really matter anyway, as long as you're trying to be good to others and to continue to become a better you. As I thought about the discrepancy between the article and the accompanying image, I began to think about the imperatives in verbal language. In advertising, each ad contributes in a cumulative way to the larger meaning and significance of the advertising as a whole. Words and images work together to define and negotiate a meaning matrix as well. The pictures I see, the talks I hear, all are contributing to the whole. So what are the verbal messages I'm getting at church? Are the brethren acting as my external conscience? I have been trained by advertisers and by my culture and society to respond to anything spoken in the capital A authority voice as a map. But what happens when the map does not represent my reality? For example, when I heard President Benson's now famous or infamous address to mothers in Zion, I wept. I thought of how many people I knew in the church who were just barely holding it together financially. They weren't making ends meet, but with both of them working, at least their ends were getting close. I thought of my own situation with a husband who had been unemployed at that point for nearly a year. He had neither training nor experience, and despite looking, could find nothing. How then, I wanted to ask President Benson, was I to come home from the factory? There was no other way for us to put bread on the table or keep a roof over our heads. I wasn't working for luxury items. I was working for subsistence. In my case, there was no way I could stay home and have children. When the time comes, I would like one of us to be able to stay home with the children. The economic reality is, if we choose to have children, it is likely we will both have to work to support the family. I want to make it clear I'm not underrating the value of primary caregivers. But I do dispute that it is a feasible or even acceptable lifestyle for everyone. I object to the assumption that only women are suitable to fulfill that role, or worse yet, that it is the only role for women to fulfill. Can we not find a more adequate way to image our Mormon reality? This come home from the factories image is only a single example. I realize there has been much more discussion in the church on this matter, but this particular image is just a part of the underlying matrix of images and imperatives in the church that are telling me what a good Mormon woman should be. I don't see myself in these images. I've met many women in the church whose example I would willingly follow, but I find few, if any, images of them in the church media either, or images in church talks to which I can relate. We need to work harder at providing a broader spectrum of images in the church to reflect a variety of blueprints within our cultural milieu and to be more conscious of the imperatives we are giving in the imagery we do utilize. Thank you.
During the past academic year, I wrote a paper for a class that I was taking about the human situation. The paper, this paper, was originally entitled The Goddess Myth Remembered. Because my professor, Dr. Mennell, was so encouraging, and my family felt that the topic was relevant to the broader aims of a feminist critique of patriarchal language practices, I'm going to present a shortened version of the original paper, hoping that you will find it, at the least, interesting. I'm a little ashamed that for some time the idea of a mother god or a goddess myth seemed relatively unimportant to me. I remember attending a Sunstone symposium in August of 1989, at which one speaker was going to talk about a mother in heaven. I avoided the class because my initial reaction was that it would be a lecture given by a woman who was angry about patriarchy and was therefore trying to promote matriarchy. I feel very badly now that I missed the chance to attend this lecture because I now know that we need a goddess myth. In The Power of Myth, Joseph Campbell suggests that the study of myths is important to education and that we have lost myths as part of our tradition. The significance of what Campbell is saying is not clear as long as the word myth is associated with false story or untruth. Campbell's ideas are based on the understanding that myths are stories about the wisdom of life. These stories are important to us because they can become models for our own experiences. Campbell says, "It used to be that these stories or myths were in the minds of people. When a story is in your mind, then you see its relevance to something happening in your life. It gives you perspective on what's happening to you. With the loss of that, we've really lost something because we don't have a comparable literature to take its place." Campbell holds that what human beings have in common is revealed in myths. They are the stories of our search through the ages for truth, for meaning, and for significance. Myths, therefore, are a way for us to discover who and what we are. Campbell says, "I think that what we are seeking is an experience of being alive, so that our life experiences on the purely physical plane will have resonances within our own innermost being and reality, so that we actually feel the rapture of being alive. That's what it's all finally about, and that's what these clues from mythology help us to find within ourselves." The foundation of Campbell's claims is the notion that if we lose our myths, then we have nothing with which to compare and validate our own experiences. Not only do we need myths, he insists, we need myths that are appropriate to our current situations and that are useful to us today and are relevant to the things that are happening in our lives. Well, what can myths do for us then? Campbell feels that myths serve four functions. The first function is the mystical function. Myths help us to realize what a wonder the universe is, and what a wonder each human being is, and to experience awe about these mysteries. The second function involves what Campbell calls the cosmological dimension. This is the dimension with which science is concerned. Science may be able to tell us how things work and help us to understand the shape of the universe, but it can't tell us the significance of the universe. The meaning of the universe that science helps us to understand remains a mystery. The third function of myth is the sociological one. Myth, in this case, supports and validates a certain social order. This is where the myths vary enormously from place to place, because the rules governing what constitutes a good society differ from place to place. We can understand this function better when we remember that myths must be appropriate to the society one lives in because myths reflect the laws of the society. Keep this in mind because I'm going to return to this idea later. The fourth function of myth is a pedagogical function. Myths teach us how to live a human life under any circumstance. Now, as I grew up, I never really saw religion in a mythical context. I accepted the Bible as a historical text, and I assumed that every Bible story I heard was fact and had actually taken place. I am now persuaded that a historical reading of the Bible and a mythical understanding are both important. Each contributes to a different dimension of meaning, and together they lead to a more complete understanding. Today, I want to examine religion in a mythical context. There are many different creation stories. In the Judeo-Christian and Mormon tradition, Father in Heaven, or God, created the world and all life on it. In a book, Creation and Recreation, by Northrop Frye, he suggests that there are two creation myths worth looking at. In one, the world was made by an intelligent father. This tradition has been associated with the father because it involves a creation in which the creator goes about his own mysterious business without nursing his children. The other creation myth involves the mother. In this tradition, creation starts with the birth of the world from sexual union. It is associated with the mother because all life comes from and is born of mother. The mother myth has been all but lost, and the father myth dominates our thinking today. I ask, are there any myths involving women in religion today? I agree with Northrop Frye, who holds that myths involving women are few. He has said that deity is associated exclusively with the male sex. Man was created first and woman out of his body, in contrast to the later fallen cycle of birth from a mother. The fall was precipitated by the female, and as a result, the male is to have dominance over her. There is no question that the story has got mixed up with the patriarchal social ideology, and no question either that it has been constantly invoked and ruthlessly exploited to rationalize doctrines of male supremacy. But within the myth itself, there is an element in the symbolism of male and female which is distinct from the social relations of men and women. It would be useful if Western thought had developed something like the classical Chinese conception of yang and yin, which would express something of the imaginative and mythological relations of male and female without perverting them in this way. The goddess is missing from the Judeo, Christian, and Islamic creation mythologies. The goddess is absent generally from most religions which are centered in Christ. The Christocentric view that Christ is the complete revelation of the divine and is closest to the image of God clearly infers that God is male. This causes serious problems for women. If women are to see religion as myth to which they can relate their own experience and to model their own lives after, how can they deal with a male model of behavior? Women who value the Christian myth must model themselves after a male savior. It leads women to question their own nature and to equate maleness and divine nature. As a woman, I find this very distressing. There is great value in a goddess myth because women need access to a feminine deity that possesses the same potentiality as they do. Because I was raised in the Mormon tradition, which focuses attention on the father god myth, and had accepted this as universal, I was very surprised by Campbell's suggestion that there have been systems of religion where the mother is the prime parent, the source. The mother is really a more immediate parent than the father, because one is born of the mother, and the first experiences of any infant is with the mother. Now, I'm not suggesting that a system of religion which focuses entirely on a goddess myth is the answer, because both women and men need access to myths that they can relate to their own experiences. Mormons do believe and accept that there is a mother god. The idea of a mother in heaven or a goddess is not absent from Mormon mythology, but merely acknowledging that she exists is not enough. The father is still seen as the immediate creator and is the focus of all our spiritual attentions. From my own religious experience, I've been taught that God the Father was the creator, but I had also heard that there was a mother in heaven. Little is really taught about this feminine deity in Sunday school, but she is referred to in a well-loved church hymn. Ironically, however, this reference to a mother in heaven is buried deep within the third verse of a hymn titled, O My Father. Melody Mensch Charles, in her article, The Need for a New Mormon Heaven, points out that it is rare in Mormonism to find Mother in Heaven in lesson manuals, and her description gives us little information about her. At best, this Mother in Heaven is only seen as one of the heavenly parents who love children. She is like Heavenly Father, who is great and good and wise and knows everything and is perfect. In summary, she exists, has some good characteristics, and she loves. This description is very vague and attributes to her no uniqueness in that all these characteristics are also used in a description of Heavenly Father. What, then, makes her so different and distinct? Charles suggests that although she is great and good and wise and omniscient and perfect, this is not the quality that she is valued for. Her value is in her fertility. She exists to procreate, not to create, to inspire, to guide, to plan, to intervene, to empower, or to comfort. I agree with Charles that Mother in Heaven's fertility is what makes her distinct, but it is interesting and worth noting that even this one characteristic that makes Heavenly Mother distinct is denied her. In the creation story found in Genesis, the singular God is used throughout the account. This could be referring to Mother God, but is more frequently attributed to Father God, since he made man in his image, and then made woman from man. We still see Father as the ultimate creator, because he created the first man and woman. I have to agree with Charles when she says that there doesn't seem to be any reason now to let such a degrading concept of the female deity continue to exist without protest. Mother in heaven can be nothing other than the faceless, nameless, unavailable for theological purposes blank that she currently is. Our theology has allowed her no authority nor power. She gets no acknowledgement for her distinctive contributions, whatever they are. She has no self apart from her husband. Unless we can begin to see mortal women as significant in their own right, we will never see our Mother in Heaven as significant in her own right. She will only have significance because of the male she married or sired. As long as she is only the eternal housewife, producer of babies and nurturer of children, mortal Mormon women will be expected to find these limiting roles satisfying. Mormon women, like all women, need to have a myth that will give them more significance than that of wife and mother. In terms of the sociological function of myth, Mormonism may be unique in its belief in a mother in heaven, but this myth is not being used to build up women. Rather, it is used to perpetuate a patriarchal system. Mormons are willing to admit she exists, but are not willing to make her a dynamic and powerful model. She is instead what all women in a patriarchal system need to be. She is supportive, a nurturer, and subordinate to the ultimate male creators. I believe that the Mormon Mother in Heaven myth serves the third function that Campbell proposed, that of validating an existing social order. This myth reinforces the idea that women are only useful as caregivers and mothers. If we agree with Campbell's notion that myths are clues to the spiritual potentials of human life, then right now, Mormon women's potential is seen only as being one of being a procreator and nurturer. I know that women's potential is much greater than this, and so I see a new myth which opens women up to these potentials as absolutely necessary. I am saddened by the fact that the Mother in Heaven myth found in Mormonism is not really worth sharing or perpetuating. But I do find hope in the acknowledgement that a goddess myth is a possibility. At least the groundwork has been laid, and in the future perhaps this myth will be recreated in a way that will be significant to women. As Campbell suggests, we may need to create new myths that are relevant to us. For me, this means rediscovering or recreating the goddess myth. I was delighted when my sister told me about a play that she was going to see. It was called Mother Wove the Morning and was written and performed by Carolyn Pearson. Although I never had the opportunity to see this performance, I was delighted to see that Pearson is trying to do this very thing, to again give women a mother goddess. Pearson says of her play, "I wrote this play to change the world. I wrote this play because it has been pressing on my mind and heart for about 30 years. Because I felt these things so strongly in myself, I assumed that others too must feel that we need the figure of the mother. We need the feminine in our lives, and the thrilling thing is that today is a day when we can invite the feminine, the mother, back into our lives. I would rather not spend my energy just blaming the past and our failure there, but rejoicing in the fact that today we can simply move forward and claim for ourselves the feminine, claim our relationship with the female face of God." For me, Pearson's play is one way to begin creating new myths about female deity, or at least a way to expand the current notions that we do have. Like Pearson, we need to be involved in creating a myth which portrays women as significant. I look forward to the time when both the god and goddess myth will be harmonious, but I realize that this can only happen if men and women change. As Fry says, when women acknowledge the good in men, men can be freed from the fear of the devouring feminine. When men acknowledge the power in women, women can be freed from subordination to patriarchy. Thank you.
In one of our impromptu sessions around the kitchen table, my father observed after a comment about, I can't even remember what, "You know, that really illustrates the difference between beneficent and pernicious imperatives." Now, those of us who have lived with my father for most of our lives know that a request for a definition invariably leads to a trip to Webster's unabridged dictionary and a 10-minute discussion of the etymology of the word. So it was not at all surprising that most mouths around the table remained closed. However, Patty, who's only been around for the past 15 years, is a little bit braver than the rest and said, "Okay, Kelvin, define those words or use a couple of normal-sized ones." To everyone's great surprise, Dad, in fact, obliged and said something like the following. The general form the imperative takes in negotiation is, "Do this for me because X." The "because X" element of the imperative contains what we will call the persuasive means. And within this, there are two main categories, the beneficent imperative and the pernicious imperative. The beneficent imperative takes the form, "because if you do it, it will benefit us both." The pernicious imperative takes the form, "because if you don't do it, I will harm you." Now, beneficent imperatives preserve your agency and your dignity, while pernicious imperatives have a coercive quality to them and demean you. Patty's rejoinder to this was, "Well, since imperatives are so seldom neatly explicit, how can you really tell which is which?" At the time, I suggested that you could tell the difference by the way they make you feel. However, I went home that night thinking a little bit more about these so-called pernicious imperatives. I realized that there were, in fact, times when I could feel the pernicious nature of an imperative long before I figured out exactly what the command itself was. In such situations, I had the feeling, "I don't really know what's going on here, but whatever it is, I know that I don't like it." So, with this litmus test in hand, I decided to re-examine two experiences that had occurred last year at about the same time. These two experiences felt related to me, though the exact nature of that relationship was not quite clear. But both experiences had frequently come to mind, and I'd spent a lot of time trying to sort them out. Now, the first experience involved my friend Marie and myself. We had bumped into each other at school one day, and a 10-minute discussion lengthened into a 4-hour discussion. During the discussion, at one point, I told her how frustrated I was feeling, trying to reconcile my personal desires with the patriarchal influences that I was feeling both at school and at church. At school, I was hard at work trying to fill a career for myself, and yet was constantly confronted by explicit messages such as, "Women don't make good litigators," and "You can't be a feminist and work in a large law firm. At church, at the same time, I was still feeling very sensitive about President Benson's talk. Other experiences that I was having at the same time seemed only to fuel this feeling of rage and lack of control that I had over my own ability to achieve my own desires. Marie listened to my tirade for a while and finally said to me, "You know, sometimes I worry about you. I worry about your testimony." Now, this amazed me, since I had never imagined that someone might actually be worried about my testimony. It seemed intact to me. But since we were on the topic, I asked her what she thought was central to the gospel and to her own testimony. This she shared with me. Now, as I listened, I could see that our lists were not identical. There were things I agreed with, things I disagreed with, and things that I thought conspicuous by their absence. She told me that she, too, felt occasional dissatisfaction in the church, felt troubled by some of the messages that she heard, that there were things she hadn't figured out, and things, like polygamy, that she did not want to accept. She shared these things with me, and then concluded by saying that though she had questions, she felt it important to follow the brethren. I remember thinking at this point, how different we are, and yet so much alike. I come from a liberal background, she from a conservative. My own religious leanings are finitist, hers absolutist. However, we both had questions that had not yet been resolved, and we were both trying to find answers. Our ways of trying to deal with our concerns are different, but this doesn't seem to be a big problem. She is concerned about my happiness, and I am concerned about hers. I went home that night feeling a very strong sense of sisterhood and thinking how wonderful it was that people could be very different and yet make a place for each other in their lives. Now, the second experience is one that I call the Breakfast Club meeting. Marie and I had agreed that Sunday school classes were particularly unfulfilling. She thought it might be helpful to get a group of us together Sunday mornings for breakfast and a pre-Sunday school class discussion. This would allow us to have a more active discussion about gospel topics. So she invited us, a group of us, to her home. The first, and as far as I know, the last topic, was the Gadianton robbers. Trevor, one of the Sunday school teachers in the ward, opened the discussion by suggesting that the Colombian drug lords are modern-day Gadianton robbers. His evidence included President Hinckley's November 89 conference address. The report had, I don't think the report was out yet, The Scourge of Illicit Drugs. Now, I was familiar with the talk, as I had actually been quite a bit disturbed by one particular passage in it, the place where President Hinckley said that the blood of those killed or injured fighting the drug cartels was on the hands of those, on the hands of drug users. At the time, I thought that the statement passed over the real problems of addiction, heaping guilt upon the heads of those already suffering addictions and upon their families in a manner which did not seem consistent with the gospel principle of personal responsibility as outlined in the second article of faith. Since I thought the meeting was to be a forum, I outlined my concern and expressed my wish that the talk had dealt with the subject in a different manner. At least three people present had family members suffering drug addictions. My assumption that this would have made them share my concern and compassion was misguided. Two of them told me flat out that they had no feelings of compassion for the addicted, who, in their opinion, should indeed share the guilt of murder. They were addicted by choice. Now, at this point, the discussion became quite heated, touched on the nature of free will, determinism, faith, repentance, the role of the prophets in the dispensation of times, and the patriarchal artillery was called in. Threatening use was made of the scriptures, Mormon folklore, priesthood manuals, and missionary experiences. It didn't really matter what I said. Two or three people were ready with reasons compelling me to believe that I was, in fact, wrong. The longer the discussion went on, the more firmly entrenched people became in their positions. And all this time, Marie and her husband were working very hard trying to reinterpret each side for the other and trying to diffuse the situation. The sister-in-law of the Sunday school teacher finally terminated the discussion by pointing out that criticism of the brethren indicates that a person is on the pathway to apostasy. Now, I knew that this was not really a general comment. I had left my meeting with Marie feeling encouraged about the church and feeling that there was a place in it for people like me. I left the Breakfast Club meeting feeling alienated, chagrined, embarrassed for Marie, and dismayed at the problem I would have calming my convert husband, who had quietly listened with angry disbelief. Yet on both occasions, the closing imperative seemed to be, follow the brethren. So why had these two experiences been so vastly different? Now my litmus test of, I don't know what it is, but I know what it feels like, suggested that the persuasive means in the first experience were beneficent, whereas in the second they were pernicious. Now, when I tried to identify precisely how the imperatives in the first were beneficent, I am now able to articulate the following impressions. Although Marie and I did not see eye to eye on every topic, she did not try to force me in any way to hold her opinion. Marie told me that she had a different opinion, but she did not invalidate the opinion that I held. She disagreed with my conclusions, but allowed me the space to express my feelings, agreed that it was possible to have such feelings, admitted that she too had had such feelings, even though she chose to react in a different fashion. Seeing my questioning, she was worried for me. However, even if she thought I was making wrong choices and had a different view of reality, she did not seem to feel it necessary to shame me into making the choices that she was making. She respected my right to make my own choices. The way that she had expressed her concern led me to feel that even if it turned out that I was in fact wrong, I would find a non-critical and non-condemning friend. She was willing to let me pursue my own blueprint and agenda, and even willing to let me express my concern about our received Mormon map. I felt that she valued me personally, respected my mind, my autonomy, and trusted my intentions. The imperatives that I heard her saying, along with the persuasive means, were two. First, be careful and cautious in your questioning, because a testimony is such a fragile thing and so important to our happiness. And second, consider my advice that in controversial matters it's safest to follow the brethren, because I love you and I believe that the brethren best understand God's will. Now, when I try to identify more precisely how the persuasive means in the second experience were pernicious, I am able to articulate these impressions. When it became clear that I held one view and the rest of the group held another, I was no longer allowed to feel that I was still a valuable member of the group. Instead, I was made to feel that my views were not only inappropriate, but they were intellectually unacceptable and myself not to be taken seriously. I felt that they could not even graciously allow me to hold my own views for my own reasons. I felt that Trevor's purpose was to silence me or to force me to hold a different view, using the tools of bad logic, unsupported assertion, and intimidation. I felt very much that I was a victim of a kind of psychological violence, but why, I couldn't quite understand until I had read Manturana's book, The Tree of Knowledge. In this book, he defines violence as holding an opinion to be true such that another person's opinion is not true and they must change. This seemed aptly to account for this feeling of violation that I had at the end of the meeting. Furthermore, I felt that not only my ideas, but that my feelings were totally unacceptable, that either I was not allowed to have my feelings, or at the very least that I was not allowed to express them. I had been truly bothered by this thing that seemed dissonant in President Hinckley's talk, but I do not believe that the men in the group could accept the fact that I had real feelings, and that I might even have reasons for feeling the way that I was in fact feeling. As to my right to hold a different view of reality, Trevor seemed to feel it necessary to shame me into making the choices that he was making. I felt very much that if my choices turned out to be wrong, I would find him with a ready self-righteous, "I warned you." He was not willing to let me pursue my own blueprint and agenda, and especially not willing to let me express my concern about our received Mormon map. I felt that he didn't value me personally, respect my mind, my autonomy, my agency, nor trust my intentions. Now, Trevor, like Marie, might have been worried about my testimony genuinely. He may have wanted me to know that he resolved conflicts by choosing to follow the brethren. But the imperatives and the persuasive means I heard from Trevor were these. Believe me, because if you question these things, it is because you don't have a testimony. Believe me, because if you don't have a testimony of the truthfulness of these matters, it is because you don't have enough faith. Believe me, because those who have the priesthood have a better connection to God than you do. Believe me, because if you turn away from the brethren, we will shake the dust from our feet and go on without you. And repent and be forgiven before it is too late, because criticism means apostasy, and you are criticizing, therefore you are an apostate. Even though I do not believe that the general authorities fully understand how central patriarchy is to general culture, nor that it is alive and well in Mormonism, I cannot believe that those in authority in the church intend to send the messages that I sometimes receive, nor that they wish me to feel so demeaned. And furthermore, since I do believe that communication is the negotiation of meaning, I cannot doubt that they would want to know that they are understood as they would be understood. I can't believe that President Hinckley would not want to know how I in fact heard his talk. Now, you've heard us say that all language is imperative. My talk is as imperative as any, but I hope that you hear the means that I am using as beneficent. I would like to articulate for you the imperatives that I hope I'm sending. First, know that it is important to distinguish between beneficent and pernicious imperatives, because understanding the difference can free you from the tyranny of patriarchal language. Remember that it is through language practices that patriarchal structures have been maintained, and it is through new language practices that these harmful structures will be dismantled. Believe that when you hear a pernicious imperative, you can know that coercive or manipulative means are being used to get your cooperation. Now, many of us use pernicious imperatives without realizing it. Those of us who feel them have a responsibility to let those of us using them know that we are, in fact, using them. Value and mobilize your own skills at negotiating. Ask questions to ensure that you will be acting on the appropriate imperative and that you understand why the other person is wishing for you so to act. If you are not persuaded, don't assume that you are wrong. Each of us has the right to be persuaded in good faith and to participate when we desire. You may eventually agree and choose to participate, and you may not. But in either case, you are a valuable free agent. This theory of language has made me feel much more empowered. Initially, it helped me to mobilize my own negotiating skills in fear, because it became apparent to me that language is imperative. We are always being commanded to do things, even if we don't recognize it. So we are all working all the time, constructing the world that we live in according to someone's blueprint. Now, from time to time, people say things like, well, you know, this is just the way life is, so, you know, you just go with it. But I'm becoming more and more convinced that life is that way because we make it that way. Unconsciously and unintentionally, working as if we have a map of reality, we turn someone's blueprint into a completed structure. In this way, myth can and does become reality. According to the oldest version of our own theology, it's always time to re-examine the received map of Mormonism to renew negotiations with God. Maybe, just maybe, women should be allowed to participate in these negotiations. If nothing else, women should certainly be allowed to tell the truth, to tell how we feel, and to tell what we need. And we should be able to do this without having to put our testimonies, our faith, or our membership on the table. For much of my own life, I have been in search of the map. I felt that Mormonism had the map. But I no longer want the ultimate map. I want to participate in the planning as well as in the building. And so now I think much more about the value of blueprints. Maps have a downside. They can be dangerous in that they encourage a sense of completion, a feeling that there's nothing more to do but follow. I hope that there are yet to be revealed some non-patriarchal social structures in which female resources will be more fully valued and utilized, structures in which women will participate because they are valued and because they wish to participate, structures in which the good in women and men will be recognized and where people can be different and yet make places for each other.
This has been so filling and so exciting to me. I've been letting my mind wander and have a notebook full of papers. First of all, let me invite you. Are you bubbling with a question? Are you overwhelmed like I am? Yes, Ron.
I've been sitting here looking at the...
Ooh, I have to go on record. To be honest, they're actually... When I initially started this paper, I thought that I would find a lot less positive images from remembering in past enzymes where all women wore lace, all men wore black suits and ties, and you never saw anybody who wasn't white. Occasionally somebody wasn't blonde, but usually white, middle class, Mormon. These are pretty consistent and perhaps even better than a lot of the commercial magazines. My understanding is everything is approved through correlation. Certainly anything in the media, Mormons are very particular about their media. As I said, they're better than they have been, and they're getting better all the time. From an artistic point of view, yes, this is nice. You have the diagonal dynamic, you have perspective, you know, you can go through the whole thing. But the thing is, where does artistic consideration start, and when does meaning start? And can you say, oh, well, this is artistic, pornographic or not? I'm not suggesting that these are pornographic, but that's a big argument in image analysis. There's meaning, there's art. You have to blend them.
Thanks, Patty. Another question. The question has to do with the statement, unless we can see mortal women in their own right, we will never see the mother in heaven in her right. And Rebecca's going to address that.
Did I understand you to be asking about are we constructing a mother god? The one thing that I love the most about Mormonism is the idea that we have this come reason with me, saith the Lord, and study it out and ask. So it seems to me that we have a lot of responsibility to, in fact, be doing the constructing. So, though I don't want to necessarily go on the record as saying, well, we're going to construct a goddess, but in some ways, we have to.
And that's great. I mean, how friendly is that to a lot of men?
I might ask that back to you. I'm not threatened.
No, I think you went up next to Sintos where I think you have to do this, and is that,
We keep saying, we've said it twice, and I'll say it again because we've had this sentence say, they say you don't, you have to hear something 12 times before you kind of get the idea in your head. So we use this sentence a lot, communication is the negotiation of meaning within our family. And I think that we would be, last night I'm sure everyone who is at the thing on Pillars of My Faith heard Levina say, you know, there's the red phone, God phones up and says, here's what I want you to do, and the prophet writes it down, and this is how, you know, Revelation goes. You know, we would be naive to anticipate that we can have this kind of a negotiation with God. We have so many problems understanding each other, trying to work out meaning, that I think we are in the same relationship with God, and I think that we have to be understand the limitations, and with the limitations comes the very joys of language, that we are involved in a negotiation, that we're working out what meaning is, you know, as we go along.
Can I just also, the family's been talking about the same question, and Catherine and I were talking one day and decided maybe it's a very good thing that the goddess myth has not been fully explicated, because until women find out who they are, right? So, you know, pornographers now image women, and women take on that reality. So until women begin to find out who they really are, apart from how pornography images us, see, that's when the myth will really begin. But it would be a big mistake to make it now with our...
The question has to do with the images getting better in the church manuals, and Dr. Paul has asked us for indications beyond this that the messengers are getting better. Can I suggest one? I was delighted to look through the new children's songbook and find the mother quite present, and the image of the heavenly parents quite evident in that new book. Others?
Well, I think the fact that there are so many.
This is a nuisance, but.
It seems to me that the fact that there are so many discussions, even in this particular forum, which are centering on women's issues, is a positive sign. I haven't seen too many women being removed from the church for their feminist beliefs since Sonia Johnson, though there may be more that I'm not really familiar with. But it's such a big problem, and it's so societal. It's not... one of the most freeing things for me about looking at feminism is I was able to all of a sudden take so many of my pains within the church and realize that it's a bigger problem, and so my target of my anger is no longer, you know, the men in the church and the and the priesthood. So I think it's a hopeful sign the more women start to look at these issues and start to recognize the breadth of the problem, I think it will make us more able as women and men within the church to really make an atmosphere that is more healthy and more freeing to women. So I think simply things like the external feminist movement is going to have lots of positive repercussions for the church.
Yes, question.
I should probably just tell Dr. Paul this myself, or this between us, but my feeling is that the change in the temple ceremony is indicative of that the church is becoming aware that women have problems, and that the patriarchy causes those problems, or at least is part of those problems. And so we've started. We really have. That's a big step forward. And I think these kinds of things, doing it.
Let me add that the beautiful thing is that the next general authorities are going to be the sons of the women that you hear presenting at Sunstone Symposia.
Well, maybe two generations.
But I've got four feminist daughters and four patriarchal sons.
Good for you.
No, this is bad. Think about my sons. Same mother. I want to present the downside. I don't think it's getting better. You know, it was like this when I was young. Now I'm old, and it's not much better. How much better is it? Don't the boys still get all the trips, and the girls still get to go to the steak?
The steps have been small, but it is better.
Well, I'll tell you, we're a long way away, aren't we, in Canada? But we don't get much information. You'd hate living there, because you have to come this far to Sunstone, you have to come this far to see here, there's other voices. You know, I don't think that doesn't feel like it's getting better to me.
I'm going to add one quick thing. Having looked at a lot of church history, women were better off in the early church. And also, having looked at the women's suffrage movement in the around the turn of the century, in some ways women were better off then, and a lot of retrenchment occurred around the war period, the World War period, and a lot of this bizarre concept of a nuclear family, which didn't exist really prior to World War II, or certainly prior to World War I. We were much more involved in extended families, and that we are seeing, Art and I don't exactly agree on this, we are seeing a little bit more movement, but we still have a lot of catching up to do, to catch up to Eliza R. Snow, to Emma Hale Smith. We have a long, long way to go, and I don't think they even had enough equality or autonomy.
I jotted down in the course of one of these presentations note that I remember from Martha Spence Haywood's diary, written about 1854, when she steeled herself to go to the tabernacle to hear Brigham Young, because she knew she was going to be reminded that a woman, be she ever so smart, can never have knowledge above her husband if he honors his priesthood. You decide if we have it better or worse. I think it's a mixed bag. Are there any other questions? Yes.
I have one more comment. My husband's a straight-line, orthodox, conservative Mormon. He wouldn't be caught dead here. And I've been coming since the first one. But we have a sense of humor, and that's why we're still married. You can only be serious for so long. When he brings up something, I say, well, you can have that as your jewel in your crown. I'll do without it. You know? And we talk a lot back and forth this way. And if you have a sense of humor, don't be serious all the time, and you'll find a little bit of every once in a while you can joke about.
You know this family. I know this family. This sounds wonderful. Let me just conclude with one thought. How many times have you heard in the course of this particular Sunstone Symposium the word story or the word language? It is exciting to me to hear people expressing Mormonism by the stories of their lives. And once more, we've had the example. This is how we're going to teach one another. This is the strongest thing that we women have, is that our stories are so well thought through. And I'm so grateful to these women for understanding their stories. Thank you.